Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Grassroots, the Minor Hockey Show. Today's episode is a special one. We've been trying to get hold of this fellow for a while. He's been traveling all over the place. Raymond, have I pronounced your last name correctly? Is it Verheyen?
Verheyen, yes.
Verheyen. Well, I was close. That's pretty good, Verheyen. Raymond Verheyen is in Amsterdam and is a world-renowned soccer coach and teacher. And I highly recommend everybody visit his website, fcevolution.com. Dean and I have spoken about his approach to coaching in episodes 78 and 80 of this podcast. And I highly recommend, again, that everybody go back and listen to those about the approach that he is taking is somewhat novel. And we're looking at how that can be, or even if that can be applied to the sport of hockey, which is a little bit more chaotic than soccer. First of all, Raymond, thank you very much for joining us today. Welcome to Canada.
Yeah, thank you for the invitation. Yes, looking forward to it.
Can we just go back to when you first started presenting the courses and writing your materials and doing the blogs? What kind of resistance did you come up against? Or did you come up against any?
Well, when I started within my own country, the Netherlands. And this way of thinking was already pretty normal. It was the benchmark in the Netherlands. And so basically I just evolved that thinking further within the Netherlands. But then once I started to travel and present abroad, once you visit other countries, other cultures, other ways of thinking, people sometimes struggle with what you present because of what they are used to. And initially that catches you by surprise, of course. But then when time goes on, you gradually understand where people are coming from. But then still you can ask yourself the question, when you play a certain sport, why is playing the sport seen as the exception to the rule? And why is training in isolation seen as the rule instead of the other way around? So yeah, that even when you try to understand where somebody's coming from, then still, it's the world upside down that a lot of people take isolation as a starting point rather than the context of the sport.
Now, I'm going to be referring to your sport, football, as soccer, because in North America, you know, football is football and soccer is somewhat different. But in your sport, has the sport been always approached in a very traditional manner? Or are people more open in that country than perhaps other countries, or not?
Well, first of all, I keep using the term football because that is the global name of the sport.
Right.
And the fact that Tom Brady and Bill Belichick have hijacked the word football, although they are playing American handball. If I would live in North America, I would still use the word football because you are playing with your feet. Mm. And I would just tell Tom Brady that he's playing handball.
Handball is a different sport, and it's a great one too, by the way. Yeah,
but let's call it American handball. So
European, I'm thinking of European team handball, which we call it here, which is, you know, 7-on-7. That's a great sport actually for teaching our game. Anyway, sorry.
And then with respect to your question, I wouldn't use the word traditional. The traditional way of thinking in the Netherlands, it is more like taking the sport, taking the context as the starting point. And that is something that goes decades back. And the reason is that coach education in the 80s has been developed by Bert van Lingen, who became my mentor. It's a funny story, actually, that in the late 80s, I was playing in the Dutch national team under 17, and he was my coach. And then I had an injury, so the classic story, you got injured, so your whole world falls apart. But then a disadvantage becomes an advantage because you can start coaching at a relatively early age, which from a coach perspective is a big advantage, of course. So I went to university, I did my coaching degree. And then when I finished my master's and I did research about the work rate of players in relation to playing style and playing position, etc., and that study that I did reached the headlines in the media. And then Bert van Lingen, who used to be my coach, saw those headlines and he thought, hey, I remember Raymond from the national team. So he called me up and he said, I want to know more about what you have done. And well, that developed into me working for the Dutch FA, becoming a coach educator, etc. But when I was at the university, I had one of the professors, which was Jan Tambour. He's a sports philosopher. And later I found out that Bert van Lingen and Jan Tambour were also working together. So I knew both of them and they knew each other. So basically, from then on, we started to work, the three of us together, in the 90s and further. But in the 1980s, Bert van Lingen and Jan Tambour, they have developed coach education in the Netherlands based on the philosophy action theory. Action theory means that you are describing human behavior not in general, non-contextual terms, but in verbs, in behavior, in action language. So basically, you are forced to say what you see rather than interpret what you see. And this action language is the foundation of coach education in the Netherlands ever since the 80s. So I think that is one of the main reasons.
Could you talk a little bit about the importance of the power of observation, which is something that Dean and I are very big on ourselves. In the last few years in hockey, out here, I've watched probably close to 2,000 practices of various age levels or training sessions of various age levels, from the six-year-olds up to juniors, 19, 20-year-olds. How important is it for coaches to learn observation?
Well, it is a matter of fact that observation is the starting point. Because the first thing you do is collect information. Before you can evaluate, before you can draw conclusions, before you can design training sessions or have a conversation with a player or develop a playing style, whatever, first you have to collect information. And that is based on observation, first of all. That's not somebody's opinion. That is just a matter of fact that observation is the starting point.
Hockey coaches don't want to do that. They want to be on the ice. Well, they're on the ice. They want to be in the activity, drill, game. They want to be the one chipping. It would be like in I'm going to use football. It would be like a football coach, chipping the ball into a corner of the field. You two players go get it. I'll stand here and watch you, as opposed to standing on the periphery. Mm-hmm. And letting somebody else chip it in and watching what's going on. Do you find that football coaches do that a lot? Are you trying to get them to think differently about that?
Well, my question would be to that coach who is standing in the middle of the pitch, what is of a higher order? What is more important for you to be a effective coach? That you are part of the exercise, or that you have the overview and that you collect all the necessary information? Well, asking the question is answering the question. as a coach, the most important thing is that you have that you collect all the necessary information so that you can make the best possible decision. And standing at the sideline gives you a better overview and allows you to collect more information than when you are in the middle of the pitch, because then you will always miss information because you are more zoomed in. So again, that is a very simple question to answer. Yeah.
Is football coaching changing? And if so, in what way?
Yes, but for two reasons. One correct reason and one incorrect reason.
Okay.
Let me start with the incorrect reason. Football coaching is constantly changing because everybody is chasing the flavor of the month. So it's almost like a dog chasing his own tail. So a lot of people are just looking at who is successful, and then they check what the successful coach is doing, and then everybody copies the successful coach. There's only one problem. Every year somebody else wins the title, so you end up copying somebody else every year. And like I said, it's like a dog chasing his own tail. So if you zoom out, then first of all, you have to create a reference. You have to understand what coaching is before you can talk about developing coaching. And coaching means that you are, first of all, communicating with your environment, and you are trying to identify possible areas for improvement. Yes. In your previous podcast, you have discussed football actions and tried to translate it to hockey. And a football action has different phases, like communicating. Communicating is the first phase. Then you have a base, and when you are communicating, you are exchanging information. And then based on that information, next you make a decision, and then you execute that decision. So communication, communicating, deciding, executing decision are the three phases of a football action. But they are not the three phases of a football action. They are the three phases of any action in daily life. So also a coach action. So a coach action is also about communicating, deciding, executing decision. So the communicating is the first phase of a coach action. And during that communication phase, you are exchanging information with your environment, trying to identify areas for improvement. Now, let's say you identify an area for improvement, so you identify a problem. So first, the first thing you have to do is you have to describe the problem. Because the better you describe a problem, the bigger the chance that you find an explanation for that problem. So, because you are looking for cause and effect. Describing the problem is the effect, and then you want to have an explanation for that problem. That is the cause. The better you describe the problem, the bigger the chance that you can find the cause, that you can find an explanation. So during the communication phase of your coach action, you are looking for cause and effect. And then based on your understanding of cause and effect, then during the next phase of your coach action, the deciding phase, you are going to look for a solution. Your decision is basically looking for a solution, choosing a solution. The better you understand cause and effect, the bigger the chance that you can find a solution, because the solution should result in a better effect. So then you have to change the cause to create, to provoke a better effect. You have effect one because of cause one. But you want effect two, but then you need cause two. So for example, somebody performs an incompetent hockey action. So that is what you see, that is what you observe. But you want to understand the cause of that incompetent hockey action. The moment you understand cause and effect of that incompetent coach or incompetent hockey action, then you have a bigger chance of finding a solution, because what you want is a competent hockey action. So you want a different effect. But that means that you have to manipulate the cause. So of course one results in effect one, the incompetent hockey action. You want a competent hockey action, so you want effect two, but then you need cause two. So that's why it's important that you understand cause and effect. So your decision is basically manipulating cause and effect. And then you have to design the application of that solution, for example, a training session, or a conversation with a player, or a team meeting. And then you execute that decision. And that is what you call a coach action. And to go back to your question, so based on this reference of a coach action, I can now better answer your question. Coaching is basically problem solving. So you are applying your knowledge. But the question now is, are you going to solve problems based on your opinion, your subjective opinion? Or are you going to try to solve problems based on objective knowledge? And a lot of people in sport in general, and in football in particular, they do not understand the difference between objective knowledge and subjective opinions. Basically, they think that everything is an opinion. Basically, they think that everything is debatable and that you can ignore everything if you want. And this goes back to how people look at experience. In football, for example, if you have played 100 games for the national team, so you have a lot of experience as a player, you have a bigger chance of getting a job as a coach. So apparently people think that experience equals knowledge, but that is not true. Because if you buy a dictionary and if you look what experience mean, if you are experiencing something, that means that you are perceiving sensory data. You are hearing something, you see something, you smell something, you feel something, or you taste something. That is the experience. So experiencing something means that you are receiving sensory data. Yes. And then you have a first impression, a first interpretation of that sensory data. But that first impression, so the interpretation of the sensory data, that is already not the experience anymore, because now you have theorized the experience. You see, so that is already theory. So if I meet you for the first time, I perceive you. I see you, I hear you, maybe I smell you, whatever. Yes? So if you meet somebody for the first time, you are collecting sensory data, one way or the other. And then you develop a first impression of that person. That first impression of that person is already not the experience anymore. You have theorized that person. So you have developed a initial theory about that person. So your first impression is already where experiencing stops. So somebody who has played 100 games with the national team is somebody who collected a lot of sensory data playing at the highest level. But now the question is, when this person was experiencing playing at the highest level, this player developed a lot of first impressions. But we all know that first impressions are often inaccurate. They are inaccurate. They are incomplete. They are subjective because you are interpreting sensory data based on the filters in your brain. So you are interpreting based on what you are used to. In other words, when you are experiencing something and then you develop a first impression of that experience, that first impression is often very, very, very inaccurate. But that's not a problem. If you then try to falsify your first impression and try to objectify it step by step, like scientists do. If I meet you for the first time, my first impression is like a hypothesis. And then you have to try to falsify the hypothesis when I meet you the second time. Yes? But you know what a lot of people do when they meet you the second time? They are going to try to look for confirmation of their first impression rather than trying to falsify their first impression of you. So they are going to look for confirmation. But your first impression is like a low resolution picture. It is blur. And only if you try to falsify your first impression, you try to create a higher resolution picture. So a clearer picture, a more reliable picture. So if you are a player who has played 100 games with the national team, you have a lot of unreliable, incorrect first impressions, which is brain pollution, because they are all illusions. Because the player likes somebody if the team is winning, but the player doesn't like something if the team is losing, which is very unreliable. If the player then tries to falsify his first impressions, then the player is going to develop reliable theory. You see? But that is not what most players do. So by the time they become a coach, these players, these former players, they have accumulated a lot of unreliable interpretations of what they experienced as a player. So they have accumulated a lot of brain pollution. They have a lot of illusions stored in their brain. And then, as a former player, they start coaching based on those illusions. And that is why a lot of top players are very unsuccessful as a coach. Yes.
What kind of brain pollution did you have after you left playing?
Well, it's very simple. If you are playing in a very successful team,
yes,
you like the exercises that the coach did. But not because the exercises are so great, but because the team was winning and it was just one big, happy, positive experience. So you develop a positive association with those exercises, which has nothing to do with the quality of the exercises,
right,
but with your memory.
Exactly.
So then as a coach, you are going to do those exercises thinking that the exercises are fantastic, but in reality, you only developed an association. And this has to do with the difference between a correlation and causality. Yeah. I always use the example, just imagine that I go to the supermarket today. And the moment I walk out of my house, it starts raining. So I get wet. The next day, I go to the supermarket. And the moment I walk out of my house, it starts raining again. So then on day two, I think, hey, this is the same as yesterday. Could this be a pattern? But I don't know yet. On day three, I go to the supermarket. And you know what? It starts raining again. So now I think, hey, this is a pattern. You see, so based on my experience and my interpretation of that experience, I now think that I have identified causality, a pattern. So then on day four, I decide to stay home because I don't want to get wet again. Do you now see that my behavior is guided by an illusion? Because in reality, I experience correlation. So two independent events, me going to the supermarket and raining, just accidentally happened at the same time. But I interpret it as a causality. So I think that it is because of instead of despite of. So if I am a player and we are winning a lot, I think I develop the illusion that it is because of the exercises that we do instead of despite the exercises we do. You see? So I confuse correlation and causality. And that is what a lot of people do in daily life. And in particular, when they are coaching football. So to go back to your initial question, because we were talking about is coaching football developing? And I said yes, for a correct reason and an incorrect reason. And we are still with the incorrect reason. People think that experience equals knowledge. Yes. And hopefully I have explained that that is not the case. Experience means that you are collecting sensory data. And then you are interpreting that sensory data. So you are interpreting what you are seeing or hearing or smelling or feeling or tasting. You are interpreting it. And that is already theory. But it is very low quality theory. It's like a low resolution picture. And a lot of people stop there. They have a first impression. And then this first impression for them is the truth. So the low resolution picture, the inaccurate interpretation of the experience is the truth. Yeah. And that is what you call brain pollution. And as a result, a lot of people, they rate experience higher than knowledge. Knowledge, on the other hand, is objective, reliable information, right? So if you could choose, if you are coaching hockey, would you prefer coaching hockey based on objective, reliable knowledge or based on subjective, unreliable interpretations of experience?
That was a rhetorical question, wasn't it, Raymond?
Yeah, because the way I have explained it,
yeah.
Now everybody who is listening understands that objective, reliable knowledge is better than subjective, unreliable interpretations of experience. But still, a lot of people are conditioned that experience is of a higher order than knowledge.
One of the things we find in hockey in this country, and I don't know if it happens in football in the Netherlands or in Europe or elsewhere, actually, is that we have a lot of coaches who boast that they've coached for X number of years. I've coached 20 years at whatever age levels or playing levels. And as one friend of mine said, well, a couple of people I know say the same thing. You've coached 20 years or you've coached 1 year 20 times. In other words, you're just recycling what you've done from years 1, 2, and 3 in years 17, 18, 19, 20. Not only that, but you're falling back to your experiences as a player and recycling the ideas and exercises and approaches you did when you were 17, 21, 25, but now as an adult of 40, 45, with a different lens and different filter and different knowledge, you're trying to repeat what you did 20, 25 years ago.
Yeah, no, it's the same in football, of course, because that is just how the human brain works in any context. Look, if you have 20 years experience, yes, first of all, I would not use the word experience based on my explanation, yes, 5 minutes ago. You have coached 20 years.
Right.
And now the question is, when you were coaching in year one, yes, when you were evaluating year one, so before year two, did you try to falsify yourself? Did you evaluate yourself? Did you criticize yourself to try to expose flaws in your coaching? And did you then correct those flaws? That would mean that year two is going to be a better year than year one. Yeah. Not necessarily a more successful year, but a better year in terms of your coaching. Yes. But a lot of people, they think that criticizing is a negative thing. They have developed a negative association with the term criticism. A lot of people, they are not criticizing themselves. They are looking for confirmation. So then, during year one, they are constantly looking for confirmation. So when the team is winning, it is because of their coaching. When the team is losing, it is because of the referee or something else or somebody else. You see? So a lot of people are looking for confirmation. That means that in year 2, 3, 4, 5, 20, they are going to repeat year 1. Yeah, and then you have 1 year, you have coached 1 year 20 times. No. So the question is, are you somebody who is criticizing him or herself? Then 20 years means progress. Or are you looking for confirmation? And then you have done 20 times the same thing. And that's what you call status quo. And look, every day, if I speak for myself, every day I try to falsify myself. Every day I try to falsify the references that I have developed, my explanations that I have developed. So what you often see when I publish a new book, then in the first few chapters, I present the improvements compared to my previous book. So in the first few chapters, I say, okay, this reference, I have improved this and this for this reason. This reference, I have improved this and this for this reason. Yes. Before I introduce the new information. And a lot of people in football, they cannot handle that. Mm-hmm. They think that if you say A to today, but you say B tomorrow, they interpret that as you don't know what you're talking about. So if you are saying A today and you are saying A tomorrow, so you are consistent, people see that as a positive thing. Oh yeah, he knows what he's talking about. No, you are saying the same thing your whole life. Yeah, that's what you call status quo. So the thing is that criticizing yourself and falsifying yourself publicly means that you are showing your vulnerability in terms of your thinking. But a lot of people cannot handle vulnerability because they take advantage of it or they try to use it against you. Yes. So showing your vulnerability is not very common in football because there are many people who will take advantage of your vulnerability. So that's why you don't see a lot of people showing their vulnerability. But if somebody would ever say to me, hey, today, yesterday you said A and today you say B, so you don't know what you're talking about. You know how what I would say to that person? Well, yesterday I was thinking A, yes, which was already better than what you are thinking today. Today I'm thinking B, and that's even better. Do you see that that is what it really is?
But B is connected to A. These are not two distinct thoughts. They're not two distinct ideas.
Well, it's an evolution, right? Like what Raymond's saying, it's Kaizen, like the process of continual improvement. Yes. And continually critiquing and falsifying yourself. I mean, Raymond, I literally have only had a couple hours to go through that first book that I held up at the start, The Football Coaching Theory Fundamentals Part 1. And I read the first couple of chapters and it resonated with me based on in your introduction or your preface even, and it talked about you were thanking some people that made a difference to you and that influenced you and impacted you. And you had people on there like Sam Harris and the Israeli fellow Yuval. Noah Yuval, I forget his.
Oh, he wrote Sapiens.
I've read a couple of his books about his take on evolution and what you're describing here, and Richard, you're bringing it up with, do I have 20 years of coaching experience or repeat 1 year? And as Raymond would say, well, it's not really experience, it's coaching. It's an accumulation. And you also refer, Raymond, to Daniel Schoen and the reflective practitioner. And I think a lot of this stuff, what you're saying is most coaches will get hung up on the day-to-day and the superficial and the subjective. And they, for whatever reason, and I don't know if you have theories on this, for whatever reason, they stay at that level and they don't dig deeper. They don't show the vulnerability. They don't, if they adopt the position of A, maybe they feel pressure to maintain that position of A throughout their coaching lifetime, as opposed to challenging themselves and falsifying themselves. And as Sean says, it's a transformative learning where you can critically reflect. And I did read your later chapters, 17, the top-down coaching, and I started it on 20, the reference coaching. And some of those things are talking about, how you design practice environments and how your players will experience first before then you apply questioning to help using those reference points to bring them to a common coaching language and a common understanding. But so many of these coaches, I think, get stuck in that the everyday concepts, because it's a little bit about dialectics too, where you have everyday and scientific competing with each other, but you're trying to appeal to the mass, to the everyday. You're trying to drive people more to the scientific, to get them to self-critique. So how do you see some of those concepts then playing out in your coaching education stuff, Raymond? And I have a few other questions around that. And even going back to your own evolution as a coach, where when you finish at U17 and you're injured, and then you go to university and you had a great experience with Jan Tambor. Again, I'm not pronouncing these names properly. And there is another fellow there in your intro, and you've mentioned his name, the two mentors that have been responsible for coach education. How would you describe your evolution yourself? Were you stuck in that superficial that top row of always repeating A, and then you learned to falsify? Or how did you break out of that? How did you evolve as a coach?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I'm happy that you mentioned the importance of referencing to people, because I think it's very important that we all understand that whatever we are thinking today, that we are borrowing the thinking of previous generations. So basically, our thinking, we are standing on the shoulders of previous generations. And there are a lot of, let's say, ego-driven people who pretend that their thinking is started with them, if you understand what I mean. I always, in my books, I always refer to my mentors. I always refer to the sources that I have used. And in the book that you are reading, for example, about also evolution, I think that 5 or 10 times in the same book, I refer to Professor Daniel Dennett from Tufts University in Boston. Because I have benefited so much from his thinking that allowed me to accelerate my thinking, that he deserves that credit.
Yes.
So I didn't mention him once. No, on every page where you borrow his thinking, mm-hmm. I mention his name, because that is how you should respect the fact that you are borrowing somebody else's thinking. I'm happy that you mentioned that point.
And intellectual property, because I know that's one thing that you've discussed. I've saw it on your Twitter, and it's a matter of respect and properly recognizing a person, like in a reference or a bibliography in a scientific journal or a book or in a lecture. I too think it's very important. Richard and I have had discussions on this. Is yes, as coaches, we're supposed to get ideas, but at the same time, I think it gives us better credibility if we share the credit and show who we're building on, so others can go back and reference that and then look to falsify, because maybe they can determine a different path, slightly different than ours to take, because we are trying to build together and share knowledge, not just I own this, it's only mine, and you're not allowed to use it, right?
Yeah, it's, I mean, in the last few years, there are a few people who have written books, and they just copy things that I have published. You have federations now who have PowerPoint presentations and other material where they just copy my content, pretending that it is their content. We have taken a few actions in the last few years to stop that. And also the reason why I also share it on social media is also to send a signal to the football world, just to basically teach people that how to deal with intellectual property. I think that's also a very important point. With respect to your question, I think the way a coach handles failure, whether somebody is criticizing himself or looking for confirmation, has a lot to do. It's not the only thing, but has a lot to do with how your brain is built. And your brain, obviously you have nature and nurture. And in particular, the nurture thing is how you grow up as a child, in what kind of environment. If we focus on two parts of the brain, if your brain is perceiving a stimulus, it can either activate your prefrontal cortex, so the front part of your brain which is heavily involved in conscious thinking, or it can trigger your amygdala, which is more in the center of your brain, which is heavily involved with emotions. Yes. So if somebody is criticizing you as a professional, so not as a person, because that's also a very important distinction. So when you are criticizing somebody's coaching, you are not criticizing somebody as a person, but you are criticizing somebody's coaching. Yes. So basically, you suggest that you have identified a flaw. Right. So when somebody is criticizing you as a coach, you have now two options. It either activates your prefrontal cortex and you will have subsequent conscious thoughts about the criticism. So basically you are reflecting now like, oh, what does the person say? Does it make sense? Can I falsify his criticism, etc.? Or the criticism is activating your amygdala, provoking subsequent emotions. So then, basically, your defense mechanism is activated. And I think that is one of the most important things. A lot of people, when they are criticized, their amygdala is activated more than their prefrontal cortex. So when that person is criticized, emotions are provoked rather than conscious reflections. And so the moment your amygdala is activated and emotions are provoked, you will be a fixed thinker. So you will protect your coaching. So you are going to look for confirmation. So you will do 20 times the same thing. If criticism provokes or activates your prefrontal cortex and provokes conscious thinking, then you are a more flexible thinker. A person who is willing to falsify himself. And then you will make progress for 20 years. So I think your brain is a very dominant factor. And obviously, we do not choose our own brain. So we are not responsible for nature. We do not pick our parents. So we do not pick our DNA and our genes. So we cannot praise ourselves for our brain, because we are not responsible for that. And we can also not praise ourselves for nurture, because we, as a person, as a child, we did not pick our childhood. We did not pick the country where we grow up. We did not pick the neighborhood where we grew up. We did not pick the school where we grew up. In other words, we did not pick the environment where we grew up. So we also are not responsible. We cannot praise ourselves for nurture, if you understand what I mean. So how our brain has evolved, at least in the early part of our life, is not something that is our responsibility. But it is a big component in how we evolved in our later parts of life. Because if we grow up as a child in an environment that is unsafe, your amygdala will be more dominant, will develop more dominantly. Or if you grow up in an environment where, whether it's your parents or your teacher or your coach, if people are constantly telling you what you are doing wrong, yes, that's also very unsafe for a child. So then that also overdevelops your amygdala. Yeah. So then if you are 30, 40, 50 years old, it is not very strange that if somebody is criticizing you, your amygdala is activated and you become defensive, because that is how your brain is shaped when you were 5 years old.
I'd like to go just in a slightly different direction here for a few minutes, Raymond and Dean, and look at some of the things you've written about on your website. Again, it's fcevolution.com for the sake of listeners who really need to go visit it. And that's the role of what I call toys in practice. This has become a disease. It's an epidemic in Canada, maybe the United States as well, that coaches bring toys onto the ice. And because of the nature of hockey, very difficult sport to play, let alone coach, because of the not just the implement of the puck, but you're using a stick and you're on skates, which is not a normal, you know, human movement. And you're going to bring toys onto the ice in practice, pylons, cones, little plastic implements for the kids to work around to practice their puck handling and practice their turning. You've written a lot about the use of toys and decision making. I wonder if you could comment on that live here on the podcast. I know we are all members of the same choir on this, but I'd just like you to comment on this, please.
Well, this goes back to my comment at the start of our conversation. The sport specific way of training and the isolated way of training.
Right.
And in football, you have basically two groups of people, and it's very polarized, and they are already in a heated discussion for decades. You should play football if you want to learn football. And then the other group says, no, you should, young children should start in isolation first. Well, the problem with that discussion is that people are having that discussion at a subjective wavelength. So they are having that discussion based on their opinions, based on their preferences, based on their subjective experiences in the past. So that's what you call subjective status quo. Yeah, I mean, why is one opinion better than the other? Because they are both subjective opinions. So the only way to solve that discussion is if we go from a subjective wavelength to an objective wavelength. In other words, we are not going to have this discussion based on subjective opinions or preferences, but on objective facts and logical reasoning. So a football action or a hockey action is, first of all, communicating. So you are exchanging information. You are perceiving information, but you are also sending information. Based on that exchange of information, you make a decision, and then you execute that decision. That is what you call a football action or a hockey action. So that's a fact. Yeah, that's a fact. And then the question is, how are we going to train this hockey action? Yes. Well, if you put cones on the pitch or the ice, rather than opponents, then there is no exchange of information anymore with opponents. So you are not communicating anymore like in football or in ice hockey. You are not making decisions anymore because, yeah, you do things because the coach told you to do that. Yes. Because the coach is the one who put the cones on the pitch. So basically, you are now executing the decisions of the coach. Yeah, you are executing the decision of the coach to put a cone there. So in other words, you are not performing football actions anymore because you are not communicating and making decisions and executing decisions anymore. And this is the power of a definition. Because the moment you have a clear definition of what a football action is, you can use that definition and the criteria within that definition to draw conclusions. Look, simple example. Just imagine that something is A, B, C, D. A, B, C, D. Yes? And now at some stage we take out C. So it is A, B, D is left. Is A, B, D still A, B, C, D? Or has it become something else? Yes? What would you say?
Oh, you're asking. Well, it's become something else.
Yeah. So is the something now
was that
still
the right
something,
answer? I just wanted to get
something
the right...
become something else.
I got the right answer, right? I passed.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, of course.
Very important.
So in other words, if you take out the opponent, yes, there is no communication with the opponents anymore. There is no decision making anymore. So in other words, some of the components of a football action are missing.
Gone.
So it is not a football action anymore. Yes. Okay. Next point.
So okay.
Some people say then.
Yes.
That. Yes, I understand what you say, but when a child is 6 years old, yes, when a child is 6 years old, we have to start in isolation first, because otherwise the child will never learn to play the sport. Well, there are different ways to falsify that. If you have six children in a park and you have six footballs, yes, what do you think those six children are going to do? Do you think they're all going to take one ball? Or do you think they're going to play three against three in the park? Well, and asking the question is answering the question. They're going to play three against three, at least most of the times. There might be exceptions to the rule, but at least most of the times. You know what that means? That you should step in and that you say, hey, stop. Don't play three against three because you cannot play the sport yet.
Hmm.
You see?
That's great.
Obviously, I'm ridiculing it, but with an extreme example. But so the argument of we have to start with isolation first because otherwise they will never learn the sport. Yeah, if that is true, then six-year-old children should not be allowed to play three against three in the park because they cannot play the sport yet.
It's interesting you should mention that, Raymond, because how often we see kids going on the ice at the beginning of a hockey practice. The coaches throw the pucks out there for the kids to play with. Some kids will play with a puck and shoot the puck against the boards. And a lot of kids will find another teammate and try to take the puck away from each other, and they'll play keep away just by themselves. But there is another issue involved here, and I'm playing the devil's advocate. And as I said at the outset, we are all members of the same choir here. We're singing the same tune. We all agree. But I'm going to throw at you this. In hockey, we have the variability of skating. And a great many people will vow on a stack of Bibles that with skating thrown into the mix, not running on your feet, that the kids need to learn skating maneuvers, which is why you have to go around, through, over, and under objects first to be able to get to a point where they can play as you just described.
Okay. I'm gonna use a football example, and then I'm gonna translate that to your ice hockey.
Okay, situation. Please.
What I often do in the courses, although we are in a classroom, I'm gonna ask people to come to the front of the room, and I'm gonna create a circle with eight people, and then with one person in the middle. So we're going to, and we are in a classroom and we have no ball, but so I'm going to try to create an 8-against-1 situation. And then we're going to pretend that we play 8-1. Okay. And then I'm going to say to that person in the middle, is this a nice exercise for you? Do you have a realistic chance of winning the ball? Yeah, and of course the answer is no. Because if you are with 8 and you make the pitch big enough, then the one in the middle has absolutely no chance. So after 30 or 60 seconds, that person is going to give up because constantly he's running for nothing. And look, once in a while, he might win the ball because somebody makes a mistake. But in general, he has absolutely no chance. So then I say to the people who are still sitting in the room, I say, look, this 8-1, are we here passing? So are we performing the football action passing? Or are we just kicking balls? So now we are communicating because there is an opponent. So we are exchanging information with an opponent. Based on that information, we are making decisions and then we execute that decision. So in 8-1, we are doing something that corresponds with the definition of a football action. So we are passing. Okay. So that is the first thing. We are passing. Okay. And then I say to the people in the room, but is this a realistic passing exercise? And then, of course, they say no. Because, look, the one opponent is not really challenging you. So you have way too much space and time. So it is underload. It is boring. So I say to these people in the room, I say, okay, so this passing exercise with one opponent is boring. It is underload. Yes? Can you please explain to me one thing? Why if an exercise with one opponent is unrealistic, it is boring. Why are all these coaches doing exercises with zero opponents? Well, and that is what you say. That is what you call checkmate. You see, because 8-1 is an unrealistic exercise, also because you don't have a lot of repetitions. And it is not going to overload your passing and your controlling of the ball. So yeah, everybody's just wasting each other's time with one opponent. So apparently, and because that is my next question, I say to the people in the room, how many of your players cannot play 8-1 on a relatively big pitch? Yeah, and they all know that 90 or 95% of their players can do that. And look. And now here comes the nuance. Look, if you have one or maybe two players, yes, then even when you play 10-1, they keep losing the ball, then maybe you have to take that one or two players out of the football context and train them temporarily in isolation as the exception to the rule. Yes, but with the majority of your players, for who 8-1 is boring, you need to introduce either more opponents or fewer teammates. So you have to make it 6-1 or 6-2 or 5-2 or 4-1. You see, you have to make it a more realistic passing exercise. So that the opponents in the middle, they also have a fair chance of winning the ball back. And that the players who are passing, that for them, space and time is reduced, not too much, but in a challenging way. You see, so what I have done now, based on objective facts and logical reasoning, I have solved this discussion between football specific and isolation, but at the objective wavelength.
Yeah.
Everybody who can play 8-1, yeah, all the players for who 8-1 is boring, they should play 6-1 or 5-1 or 4-1. In other words, football specific. And for the one or two players who keep losing the ball even when you play 10-1, isolation is the perfect exception to the rule. So at the subjective wavelength, it is football specific versus isolation. But at the objective wavelength, it is sport specific and isolation. Sport specific is the rule, and isolation is the exception to the rule. You see? So now you can solve a discussion that is going on already for a century at the subjective wavelength. You can solve it in 10 seconds by going to an objective wavelength.
But we're still stuck with, well, we're hockey traditionalists who will still swear up and down, again, on a huge stack of Bibles, that kids must learn skating technique before they can actually participate in any kind of activity, even if it's passing in a rondo type environment like you're just describing. My argument has been trying to get them to go from a subjective approach to an objective approach is, have you ever watched those children on skates play a game of tag? And you create the space. It could be four kids inside one of those circles on the ice. If they play a game of tag, what skating techniques are they using? A vast array of them. All the techniques you need to learn, they are actually employing without knowing them. And that's the secret of teaching, isn't it? Children learn through play, children learn through experience and through discovery. And that's what we need to do in our sport, is more of that, and being giving the kids the opportunity to try these things. That's pretty much what you've been saying with the 8-against-1 example in football.
Well, first of all, there is a fundamental problem. And the fundamental problem has nothing to do with hockey, but with how the discussion takes place. Look, you have the hockey context and you have isolated training, right?
Yes.
And I see the same in football. The traditional thinking people, yes, they take the position that you should train in isolation until or unless proven otherwise. You understand that that's the world upside down?
Yes.
No. You should train in hockey unless proven otherwise. So in other words, the responsibility to prove yourself is not with the hockey specific people. The responsibility to prove yourself is with the people who are advocates for isolated training. They should prove why you have to step outside the hockey context, not based on their opinion, mm-hmm. not based on their past experiences, no, based on objective facts. So they should use arguments that cannot be falsified. You see? Mm-hmm. But people who are advocates for isolation, they make a statement. You should learn to skate in isolation first before you can play hockey. So they make that statement, and then they're going to sit back, and then they're going to wait for somebody to mm-hmm. prove that you have to be hockey specific. Yeah, I hope that everybody understands that that's the world upside down.
Yeah.
No, you are going to teach six-year-old children hockey actions, maybe 8-against-1, doesn't matter, unless somebody can prove that you should do 8-against-0, because that is basically what, when you train skating in isolation, it's basically a number of players against nobody.
No.
So the 8-against-0. Yeah. And so that is a fundamental problem. So first of all, you have to correct that situation. Who should explain themselves? The hockey specific people or the advocates for isolation. Yeah, and hopefully that is clear now. Mm-hmm. That advocates for isolation should come up with arguments that are not falsifiable. So, and I don't know enough about hockey, but I know enough about football that you can create situations, yeah, with one opponent that even six-year-old children can skate with one opponent compared to and which makes skating without an opponent unnecessary. Mm-hmm. There must be possibilities.
Well, there are.
So the other question is,
yes,
if there are situations where you can do that, so you can make six-year-old children skate and there is only one opponent, yes, if that is possible, then the problem is solved. Because now, if you do 30 minutes skating with one opponent, or you do 30 minutes skating without an opponent, in both 30 minutes, you are improving your skating. But in the 30 minutes of skating with an opponent, you are also developing your communication and decision-making. Do you understand that now the whole discussion is gone?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, it starts with doesn't it start with a definition of what is a hockey action? In the same way as you said, what is a football action?
Well, the action versus movement, I think, is what Raymond has in his book, yes. Like a sports-specific action versus just a movement, right? So the last question I kind of had today was, I know you're approaching this from a kind of a psychological angle, Raymond, with your background, I think, because your master's was in psychology, was it?
Exercise physiology and physiology. Sports psychology.
I know you've got that strong physiology background because some of your books are on, you know, periodization and applications through that. With respect to the developing brain in kids, maybe you could just talk about what the advantages are, and this might also bring out some of the physiology stuff that I've read. What are the advantages in youth sport, either football or hockey, of using smaller space, smaller numbers, and that sort of thing? Like, what are the benefits to doing that at a younger age?
Well, if you take the reference again of a football action, and it's probably the same in hockey, we have mentioned and explained a few times that a football action is communication, decision, execution of that decision. And then you can have training sessions where you can emphasize on communication. So those are tactical sessions, because with tactics, you can improve the communication between your players. You can emphasize on decision making. Mm-hmm. So then you are developing the gaming side of your players. Or you can emphasize on executing decisions. So that is football technique training sessions. Yeah, so when you emphasize on C, I always visualize that with a capital C, and then small D and E. So capital C means you are overloading communication.
Yeah.
When it is a capital D training session, so small C, capital D, small E, you are overloading decision-making. And when it is small C, small D, capital E, you are overloading the execution of a decision. So that is football technique training. Well, if you want to overload communication, yes, that means that you want many channels of communication. So that means that you want to train with large number of players. Okay, so then you're going to play big games like 11 against 11 or 9 against 9. Because then there are a lot of teammates and opponents. So there is a lot of exchange of information happening simultaneously. So now you are overloading communicating. Because which channel of communication are you going to prioritize, right? Mm-hmm. So that's very, it's a lot of overload on C. Okay. But if you want a capital D training session, so you want to overload decision-making to develop your game insight, the last thing you want is miscommunication. Miscommunication is the enemy of decision-making training. Why? Because if there is miscommunication, you cannot train decision-making, because the miscommunication is going to negatively influence your decision-making. So now first you have to solve the miscommunication before you can emphasize on decision-making. Now, how can you avoid that? By reducing the number of players. Because if you reduce 11 against 11 to, let's say, 7 against 7 or 6 against 6, you are significantly reducing the chance of miscommunication. It can still happen, but significantly less. And if there is significantly less miscommunication, you have created a more healthy environment so that you can emphasize on decision-making without miscommunication disturbing the process.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So big games when you want to overload communication, smaller games when you want to overload decision-making and avoid as much as possible miscommunication. And now the last thing is capital E training session, so football technique training session. Well, if you want to improve the execution of decisions, what is now your worst enemy? Poor decision making.
Mm-hmm.
Because otherwise you end up improving the execution of a poor decision, and you don't want that. So how can you now significantly reduce the chance that you are making poor decisions by reducing the number of players even further? So you're going to play 3 against 3 or 2 against 2 or 3 against 2 or 4 against 2 or whatever. So when players are still making decisions, but most decisions are obvious,
mm-hmm.
you would now have a significantly smaller chance of poor decision making. Yeah, so when most decisions are obvious, it means that most decisions will be correct, which is a perfect environment so that you can emphasize on the execution of those correct decisions.
Mm-hmm.
You see? So capital C, so tactical training session to improve communication, big games. Capital D, so game insight training to improve your decision making, is like the medium games, 7 against 7, 6 against 6. And capital E, football technique training to improve the execution of decisions, small-sided games, so a few players. Okay, so this is like a reference that I have introduced.
Mm-hmm.
And now the question is, what are you going to do at which age?
Mm-hmm.
Well, very young children are selfish people, right?
Mm-hmm.
But not because mm-hmm. they are bad people, but because that is how they are when they are 6. They are selfish because their prefrontal cortex is very underdeveloped still. And you need your prefrontal cortex if you want to work together with other people. And because thanks to your prefrontal cortex, you learn to look at things from somebody else's perspective.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want to develop teamwork, you need a prefrontal cortex that is already matured a lot, which is only from the age of, let's say, 13, 14 years old. So capital C, developing the communication between players, so tactical training, is only relevant from the age of, let's say, 13, 14 years old. Because then the prefrontal cortex allows you to develop communication with your teammates.
This aligns perfectly with a study that Sweden and Finland just finished about 2 years ago with the IIHF, International Ice Hockey Federation. And they concluded that the only age group that really benefits, if one can call it benefit, from a full ice game is at about age 14. Under age 14, as I say, there's just too many decisions for kids to make. There are too many players involved. Too big a space.
There's too much communication.
Too much going on, yes.
That is the main problem.
It's overwhelming.
There's too much. There's right. too much communication. So the when you you are from Canada, the country of long-term development plans.
Yes.
Supposedly,
if you look at the underlying knowledge, when you look at how the body of children develops, between the age of, let's say, 6 and 9, that is where your nervous system mm-hmm. is developing. That's what you call a critical phase or a window of opportunity, or what kind of terminology people use. So your nervous system is the signal from your brain to your muscles, which means your coordination, which means executing decisions. So capital E training sessions are dominant from the age of 6 to 9. And then by the time children are getting 9, 10, 11 years old, they start to develop their own opinion. They start to take ownership of things. They also want to have a say. They want to decide for themselves. So that between 9 and 12 is a perfect age where you can emphasize on capital D, decision-making training sessions. And then from the age of 13, 14 onwards, when the prefrontal cortex starts to be more matured, and by the way, the prefrontal cortex is only fully matured by the time you are 21, 22. But when you are 13, 14, the maturation of your prefrontal cortex is already so much that teenagers become more open for working together with other players. Mm-hmm. So 6 to 9, capital E, 9 to 12, capital D, 13, 14 onwards, capital C. So 6 to 9, small numbers, mm-hmm. 9 to 12, medium numbers, 13 and older, large numbers. And hopefully, everybody who's listening as well, hopefully, besides the thing that we are discussing right now, hopefully it is also interesting for them how I try to explain it. Because in the beginning of our conversation, I was talking about subjective opinions and objective knowledge. Yes?
Yeah.
And everybody should ask him or herself the question, if I listen to a podcast, do I want to hear what somebody's subjective opinion or preference is? Or do I want to listen to somebody who is really good at objectively and in a simple way explaining something? You see? And that's the difference between knowledge and an opinion.
I think you've done a masterful job of explaining it, that people would listen to this podcast numerous times, Raymond. we waited 3 or 4 months to get you on today, and it's been very informative, very helpful. We're going to have to wrap it up here before we go on too long. What a refreshing look at coaching and approaches. I thank you, Raymond, for being on with us today.
Yeah, you're welcome. I enjoyed it because it's always nice also to talk about the same knowledge and logical thinking, but then apply it in a in a different context than football.
Yes.
Because and, then it's a unique way of testing your thinking and hypotheses.
I may, from this point on, refer to the NFL or the CFL here, Dean, as handball. I don't know if I can call it football anymore now that Raymond has corrected us that what Tom Brady has done is handball. But Dean, thanks again for co-hosting. Raymond, my best wishes to you for a successful year. And my thanks again for being on the show today. If listeners have questions, they can reach me at richard@grassrootsminorhockey.com. You've been listening to Grassroots, the Minor Hockey Show, with our special guest from Amsterdam, Raymond Verheyen. And I hope to see you in a rink somewhere. Raymond, I probably won't see you in a rink. But Raymond, if you are in the Toronto area, please look me up. If you're in the Calgary area, look up Dean. We'd be happy to take you out for, do we have Dutch beer over here, Dean?
Oh, yeah, Hoegaarden.
Hoegaarden, okay. That's good.
It's
that's
Belgium.
Awesome. It's Belgium.
But, I will, because when I'm in the US or in Canada, I always try to go to games, whether it's baseball or basketball or,
oh, great.
Or in this case, ice yeah. hockey, because I've been to the LA Kings and the Chicago Blackhawks, so
yes.
Looking forward to an ice hockey game in Canada as well.
And you're an Edmonton Oilers fan, and that's okay. We won't hold that against you because Dean is Calgary and I'm Montreal Canadiens, so never the twain shall meet. Thanks again, Raymond. Dean, until next
thanks.
Time, everybody.
Good luck with the
thanks, Raymond. I'll be looking you up, no doubt. Love to exchange some more cultural, historical perspectives with Goose Hiddink. I can't pronounce his name.
Never mind.
South Korea and all that. That'd all right. be awesome.
All right.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks, gentlemen. Till next Bye-bye. Time. Bye-bye. Bye.
Bye.